cosmological model, the field is moving towards towards studying large-scale structure in more detail. And so there's a bunch of new surveys that are underway, different type of observables, some of them new ideas about how to make maps of the universe at different redshifts with using different tracers and so on. And so we might expect progress on the observational side on that front. So so I will briefly talk about so what I want to do now in the first lecture is to briefly talk about some of these open questions to make some simple points about them. And then if we accept the fact that we are going to try to use large-scale structure to try to answer some of these questions, then I will give you first a small introduction to just linear theory, how large-scale structure works, in case some of you, you know, I'm sure not everybody has looked at these kind of things before. Then I'll tell you about some exact results that we know in large-scale structure. And then in the second lecture, I'll tell you about recent progress in trying to make model better the evolution of structure. Okay, so we already discussed this history of the universe as we have compiled it. So, and in this history, there's a bunch of periods, especially from example at the beginning that we discussed yesterday, that we don't know much about. And so what I was saying then was that probably it will be from large-scale structure that we might get more answers to some of the questions that we have. And the main reason for that being that we've basically mapped the CMB to completely. It's not 100% true because we have not made maps of the CMB polarization with the same fidelity that we have for the temperature. And also the polarization can be mapped to a slightly higher angular scale. So there is some additional information in making better maps of the CMB polarization. But in many respects, we've done almost as much as can be done with the CMB. Now, the problem with large-scale structure, so with the CMB, we see how the universe was 400,000 years after the Big Bang. These small inhomogeneities grow with time thanks to gravitational instability, and they start forming objects and so on. And so we might hope to try to disentangle from how these objects form, when, and how they cluster and so on, more information about our cosmology. So so for doing that, we just need to follow how the different components in our universe, the dark matter, the baryons, and so on, move around under the influence of gravity. So we end up solving some sort of Poisson equation for the gravitational force, some equations of a fluid or something like that to see how things move, different components for different equations for different components. They might have other forces other than gravity, pressure, and so on, so equations like that. But we are solving them with some sort of stochastic initial conditions. So inflation gives us some, in some region of the universe, some stochastic, some initial conditions, which we think are, say, a Gaussian random field of some kind, and we evolve them forward with equations like this. And then we compare the final answer to the observations, and we try to infer properties about these initial conditions and about the details that we put into these equations if it's not just dark matter. So, and I already told you this model pretty much works quite well and blah, blah, blah. So let's discuss some of the open questions, because I want to stress a very simple point, that some of these open questions that are still open, some of them are detailed questions that, in order to make progress, required very, both very, very precise measurements and also theory accompanying them, and astrophysical modeling of various things, because we've already measured them in some sense, many things pretty well, and so to make progress, it's not so easy. And other questions are more in the qualitative ballpark. So even the first measurement of certain things are still interesting from the point of view of just making this history of the universe. So I'll just give you some of the examples of the things people want to measure just to illustrate this point. So of course, one of the main motivations for doing these large-scale structure surveys is to see if we can measure better the value of the cosmological constant, and perhaps this is not really a cosmological constant but something else. So make a detailed measurement either of the expansion history of the universe or how a structure is forming, in the hopes of getting some more information about dark energy. And one of the methods that is being used is using large-scale structure. So if you look at the correlation function of objects, the probability that if you have, say, a galaxy, there's another galaxy at a given distance, that's some sort of power law, but it has a bump at a scale around 100 megaparsecs. And that bump is just the same thing as the acoustic, as the wiggles in the CMB power spectrum. It's just the same thing in real space, is a reflection of these sound waves that were moving across the universe at recombination. So the physics of this is identical to the CMB physics. We know exactly in megaparsecs the size, because it's just connected to the CMB. So once we know we have observed the CMB, we know where this bump should be, and then we investigate at what angle we see it, or at what in separation in redshift, and from there we can infer distances and so on. So that's a way of measuring dark energy. The point. So this is the current. So this is some measurements of the distances and so on by this method. The only thing that I want to point out is that we are already at percent level precision for these kind of things, and in the future, if you start looking at what people want to do, the percent of error bars in this determination of distance from these kind of measurements that people expect to get from the next generation of surveys is in the sub-percent level, okay? So in order to achieve this, we will need to model. So this is a measurement of large-scale structure to get this bump in the correlation function. You can also do it in the power spectrum of the tracers. You need to understand things at the sub-percent level. This is the error in the experiment, so hopefully the theory is better than this by some reasonable factor that you are, so you're confident that if you find something, you have things under control. So this is one example in which the effect, to get some interesting science out of large-scale structure, you already have to have theory at the, you know, 10 to minus 3 or more or better level, okay? Other interesting questions is the effect of neutrino masses on the clustering. So if neutrinos have a mass, they make the growth of structure go differently and so on. But again, the difference, this is just a plot of difference in the power spectrum of the amplitude of fluctuations as a function of scale that you might expect for if the neutrino masses sum to something. And, you know, the values that we are thinking about are, you know, it will put the changes around here, right? Say if you just take just from the minimum amount of the sum for the neutrino masses that we know from the different measurements, from the measurements of the difference in neutrino masses. So that is again, if you want to use the large scale structure to see evidence or determine the sum of the neutrino masses, then again, it's at the percent level precision that you need to, the effect is at the percent level. As we already discussed, the questions about the early universe, like non-Gaussianity, or even if you want to measure better the spectrum of the fluctuations or running and so on, they also require sub-percent precision. So, you know, already the non-Gaussianities were, we discussed this the other day, but we already constrained the non-Gaussianities and, you know, this well. If you ask the question over some few decades that we measure the power spectrum, a change in slope given by this, how much does it change things? So to know what kind of precision you need in order to make this contrast better, again, sub-percent. So and it's kind of obvious. We already discussed this yesterday. So the CMB measured So it measures a million modes. Most of these constraints that we get from cosmology are fitting parameters to this power spectrum of the CMB. Say if you measure it with the CMB, that has this kind of precision, square root of 10 to the 6, or 10 to the minus 3 precision. So anything that the CMB has already measured, then we know it basically to this sub-percent precision. Okay, it's not exactly, this statement is not perfectly correct when you look at the table of data, because we parameterize things in ways that are a little bit degenerate. So sometimes two parameters can compensate each other, and even though we've measured the power spectrum of the CMB to this precision, we can trade one parameter with the other. So those parameters, we might know them to few percent or something like that, because they're not perfectly degenerate, but they are a little bit degenerate. But roughly speaking, anything that the CMB has touched, if we are going to make any progress, we will need to do things at the sub-percent level in the measurements, and then in the theory, even better than that. So that's one point. It's a trivial point, but I think it's worth keeping in mind. But not all the questions are like this in cosmology. Some questions are still quite, we know pretty little about. So, for example, the epoch of the formation of the first stars, what we call the end of the Dark Ages, when the first star formed, and the first galaxies, what are their properties? No, very little about. We haven't seen any of these first stars, or we don't, or these first galaxies. The influence on the things that we observe better in the later universe is pretty small, and it's difficult to disentangle things from other uncertainties that we have. So that period, which is a period that you can access using observations like, for example, these 21-centimeter measurements and so on, we know very little about. And so if you just were to look at papers in that field and ask, so talking about the epoch of renization and so on, just open a random paper and look at the, so they say, oh, you need to measure power spectrum of this signal, whatever, and you see the different models. They don't differ by fractions of a percent. They are huge, order one difference between if this is the case, if this is other the case. So when we start making measurements about that epoch, you know, we still know nothing. So order one measurements and order one theory is good enough, okay? So if you work on this kind of subject, then you don't have to make a theory to sub-percent level, but you need to get 10% things is good, okay? So these are two, this is an example of another. We're not going to learn fundamental physics from this, but so it depends on your interest, but it's still, there's quite a few open questions that are not precise. And of course, the biggest question of all is, where are the aliens? And this is the biggest question of all, I think. I don't know that we will make any progress, but why we haven't seen them, or are we really alone? That's a pretty deep question. I don't think if we ever see them, we don't need a theory of what the aliens look like at the sub-percent level. Just to see them would be good enough. So if you have some progress that you can make in this question, there is just a, you know, order of magnitude is good enough. So that's the kind of questions that are floating around, the summary that I want to say then is just this simple point. So things that the CMB and other of these detailed measurements that we already have already touched, they are, we know that to sub-percent level, and so it's tough. Other things are more open, but to the extent that with these large-scale structure surveys, we want to tackle either non-Gaussianity or dark energy or neutrino masses, all of this stuff, we will need to be able to do things at a new level of precision, both for the theory and for the experiment. Whether this can be done or not, it remains to be seen. It's a challenge, but I think it's an interesting thing to see if we can take a next step, but it's not going to be so easy. Okay, so with that said, I will start discussing large-scale structure. I will take the point of view that we are interested in making measurements at this new type of precision, and that the CMB, we will not get much out of the CMB. I already told you some caveats with that, with the CMB polarization, but let's just forget about that for a second. And we will then, as a result, need to be able to do measurements and theory for large-scale structure at the sub-percent level. And so I will start discussing that. But first, I will just tell you about just the basics of large-scale structure. The first point that that we will go through in this first part is just go through the physical effects that we are trying to use in order to constrain things like the dark energy and so on. But the first point that I want to make is that, so inflation puts into the initial condition some almost scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations. So if you were to measure, say, the amplitude of the gravitational potential fluctuations on different scales at the very beginning, it would be almost a scale invariant spectrum, a power law with this difference from scale invariant, which is very small and as measured by Planck. But the universe that we observe today with large scale structure is not at all scale invariant. Okay, so there are many scales in this problem, and some of them are pretty close to one another, and in a sense that makes it harder to model things, but those are the scales that have been imprinted through the evolution that we are trying to measure in detail to answer some of these questions, like in the case of neutrinos, the distance they can travel because of the thermal motions, or this BAO scale, or blah blah blah. So it makes our life more difficult to model all of these effects. However, this is where the information is coming from. So let's discuss some of these effects and such in a way that then I can summarize some basic things about large scale structure, just the linear theory. So as I told you, you are solving some sort of equation. So some sort of equation for the gravitational potential. You can think of the universe as made up of various fluids, of dark matter, of baryons, and so on, following an Euler equation and a continuity equation with these stochastic initial conditions. Sometimes, for example, numerical simulations of dark matter, they don't solve these equations. What they solve is they start with a collection of particles and they see how they move. So they solve, so they the particles that, say, started, you put an initially homogeneous, more or less, distribution of particles, which in a numerical simulation means more or less particles in a grid. Okay, let's call these initial positions Q. So it's, that Q is just the label of the particle and the initial position. And then you solve how it moves, and it moves something like the Newton law, okay, with the force of the gravitational potential. And then with the position of all the particles, you calculate the density. With the density, you calculate the potential. You do that. Okay, so that's what kind of a numerical, that's called Lagrangian equations. So you're following individual particles, or you can do a fluid. So usually it's a combination of these type of equations that you're trying to solve. Okay, so then the first thing that I'm going to do is, in the particular case in which you linearize this equation, so for example, you drop this term, you drop this term, you drop this term, just linear evolution, what are the properties of the answer? Okay, so this answer depends very much on what the matter that it makes the universe is, right? So let's discuss what's happening what solution you get for these kind of equations when after the radiation era, in the matter era. So let's assume that the universe is just filled with cold dark matter for simplicity. So you just linearize this and solve it. What do you get? Okay, so during the matter era, you find the following. The Friedmann equation is such that scale factor is this just the background equation is h squared proportional to 1 over a. And then when you solve these equations for the density, you find that the density contract grows like a. And as a result, the gravitational potential is constant if you just plug in this 1 over a here. And the, for h squared and delta going as 1 over a, the gravitational potential is constant. Well, so this is so during the matter era, gravitational potential is constant, density grows. This is the formation. As density, you start with the small fluctuations, 10 to the minus 5, and they grow until they get big, order 1, and then you form some objects. That's how things are progressing. Okay. Great. So the things to note is that if you do the same exercise during the radiation era, you realize the following. So during the radiation era, h square decreases faster than a because the h, the matter, the density reaches faster as a to the fourth and as opposed to a cubed. So this one decreases faster. The density is not growing because there's when you have a fluid with like this radiation fluid has pressure, and so even though gravity might try to make it collapse, the pressure stops it, and so. Because during the radiation era, the sound speed is almost is one third. Sound speed squared is one third of the speed of light. Pretty much no fluctuation can collapse. You have these acoustic oscillations. As a result, the gravitational potential then decays with time because delta does not grow. H goes even faster down than this, and so phi decreases. Okay. So during radiation era, gravitational potential goes down as opposed to being constant. In the matter era, it's constant. Just another simple point is that you can ask the so this is just a trivial point, but during the matter era, I told you the density fluctuations grow like a. The CMB anisotropies are 10 to the minus 5 or a few times 10 to the minus 5, and that's at a redshift of 1,000. Okay, so if you multiply 10 to the minus 5 by 10 to the 3, you don't get delta of 1, okay? So how come we have formed anything if there doesn't appear to be enough time, okay? The solution to that problem is another indication of the presence of dark matter. And this is how one of the reasons dark matter was introduced into the cosmological model in the early on. It's that even though the temperature anisotropies are 10 to the minus 5, at recombination, the contrast in the dark matter is bigger than that. And it's 10 to the minus 3 or so, it depends on the scale, so in order to be able to form things by the time we get to today. So that's so already when the first experiments of the cosmic microwave background, I don't know, in the 70s or whenever it was, or 80s or something, started not seeing putting upper limits on the anisotropies in the CMB, and eventually they got below 10 to the minus 3, it was clear that something was wrong. I mean, this was a prediction that there should be fluctuations in the CMB at the level of 10 to the minus 3 because you only grow by a factor of 10 to the 3 to form things as we see today. So people were optimistic that they would see something. The experiments went out there, and they didn't see anything, right? So and eventually you had to introduce dark matter in order to fix this. Okay, now we have a lot of evidence, but that's another indication. Anyhow, I'll show you now some plots of the various quantities for you to see. So first. So there is this separation. If you think of a wave number that is very long, then it was only inside of the of our horizon during the matter era. The gravitational potential is always constant during the matter era, and so if you look all modes that are so this line here separates modes that are long, so long that they become of the size of the horizon after the matter radiation equality. This became of the size of the horizon before, during the radiation era. If you plot the gravitational potential today, you discover that we don't have a scale invariant equal size of the gravitational potential everywhere, but there's this big suppression on scales that are on this scale. So compared to just the constant, if the universe had only been matter era, it would forever, this would be aligned like that, okay? And this big suppression of several orders of magnitude is the result of the fact that we had a radiation era in our universe, okay? So this scale over here has to do with matter-radiation equality, okay? Then you can ask the question, you can, this is for the gravitational potential, the Laplacian of the density is the gravitational potential, so you divide by k square, or for this plot, which is the power spectrum k to the fourth, this is the amplitude, this was the amplitude of fluctuations in the gravitational potential. This is the 10 to the minus 5 square. This is why the size is like that. Then you calculate the amplitude of fluctuations in the density. You need to multiply this curve by k to the fourth. This is the same curve. And here is the value of 1. So delta fluctuations of order 1. So this side is nonlinear scale, difficult to model. This is linear theory as you go here. The transition is around k of 0.2 or 0.3, something like that. So it's in this plot is over here, is well on modes that enter the horizon in the radiation era, okay? And so for how structure forms, we are not dealing with a scale invariant spectrum, which would be a line, the inflationary scale invariant universe. We call it transfer function, this thing, this decay. But this fact is very important. It changes the slope, it changes of the fluctuations, it changes who is collapsing. So had it been continued the scale invariant, this would be a line like that, something like that. And so you would cross one at a completely different scale. Objects forming today would be much larger than the ones that are forming in our actual universe. Okay, so for understanding large-scale structure, matter-radiation equality is completely crucial. Okay, yep.
I might have missed this, I'm sorry. What are the two different power spectra?
This is the fluctuations in the gravitational potential. So, one thing is Laplace. So, from this, 4 pi g or h squared delta. Okay. So, one is the power spectrum of phi. So, the 2-point function of phi. The other one is the 2-point function of delta. If I go to Fourier space, k squared. So, delta is k square phi, so the delta-delta power spectrum is k to the fourth times the phi-phi power spectrum, okay? So while this is flat, this is not flat, okay? Any other question? Okay, so this is the first scale, and it's crucial for structure formation. The other one is the wiggles in the CMB. So what's going on is, so in the CMB, the photons and the baryons were doing these oscillations together, results in these wiggles that we see in the CMB. Then the baryons fall into the dark matter potential wells, but the baryons are some few percent, I mean, it's not a completely negligible amount of mass, so it modifies where, in reality, also the dark matter follows a little bit the baryons, and then at the end of the day, the combined power spectrum of the entire matter, dark matter and baryons together, has these wiggles that are the same wiggles as the ones in the CMB, decreased in the CMB. It's a huge, you know, you can see them here, you barely see them, and the reason is that it was only the baryons that had these wiggles in them, and then the dark matter didn't, and for the most part, most of the matter in the universe is dark matter, and so these are less there. But anyhow, those wiggles, the Fourier transform of those wiggles gives you this peak in the correlation function, which is what we are using for BAO scales. So then notice that the location of these wiggles, and I'll point this, the location of this wiggle and the location of this matter radiation equality peak is more or less similar, and this has to do with the fact that the redshift of matter radiation equality and the redshift of recombination are very similar. So another interesting quantity is if I ask the question by how much, if I take one of these dark matter particles in the simulation, from its initial position to the final position, it moved by some amount, S. Okay, I was calling it S in the previous. How big are these motions? So the power spectrum of this S is being plotted in this. And so if you linearize the relation between density and S, the density is just the divergence of S. So so this is, if you want, the power spectrum of S, okay? So of these motions. So if you want to get the power spectrum of S, you need to divide delta by 1k, okay? So this is the motions are delta divided by k, or the power spectrum of the motions is the same as the power spectrum of the density divided by k squared. This is that power spectrum, just to point to you that now if you think about the motions, so this is how big the motions are and which modes contributes to the motions. And you can see that most of the motions are contribute, there's a big peak in this power spectrum. So most of the motions are produced by modes whose size is comparable to the horizon at the matter radiation equality. And that, the reason for that then is just the shape of the power spectrum because of this transfer function. That's then another, matter radiation equality plays a big role in a lot of things. Here is another plot where what I've done is take out, so here you could barely see this BAO wiggle, so what I did is just put a smooth curve through this, and now I plot the wiggly residuals of these. So these are those wiggly residuals, so that you can see where those wiggles are compared to the place. This is this transfer function, the power spectrum of the square root of the power spectrum of the potential. So you can, it would be one if the universe was always matter dominated, but this fall here is because of the matter radiation equality, so that you can see that the wiggle sit right there in the place of matter radiation equality. And here, similarly, now it's the same plot of the power spectrum of the displacement. It looks a little bit different because it's not log in this scale, but that I plotted here, this guy, just in linear in this direction, compared to the wiggles, this wiggly line. Again, so that you see that the modes that produce most of the displacement are just the same modes that are of the BAO, okay? So just so that you have these things in mind. In the form of the correlation function, so if I Fourier transform this power spectrum, I see this correlation function that in our universe has this bump. Okay, this is the BAO bump that people use to try to determine distances and so on. This line over here would be the shape of this correlation function if there were no baryons. If I just had done everything with only a dark matter universe such that there were no BAO wiggles, okay? So what would be the correlation function in a universe with no BAO wiggles? It would be like this, okay? And so this is the difference from the BAO wiggles that people are trying to detect. And one thing, so you can see that this correlation function goes through zero, the one without both of them go through zero. But in a sense, this is helping out, even though the baryons are such a small. So if you look at this plot here, of one of these power spectra, the wiggles are barely visible. You look at this and say, oh, it's just, there's nothing to see. However, if you Fourier transform that and look at the correlation function, it looks like a huge effect. At 100 megaparsecs, if there were no wiggles, the correlation function will be like that, and it's actually like big, very big effect. So all these wiggles in real space, even though the signal of the wiggles is quite spread out on a lot, so there's a wiggle starting here and so on. So all of these wiggles over here, all of that difference collapses into just one small region in real space, making the difference between the two things much more evident by eye. Okay, and also you are a little bit lucky that the correlation function was in any case going through zero, very close, was very small because it's very close to the place where it was going to zero. So if you plot If you plotted the correlation in log, you would have seen this. It was going through zero here. And the BAO wiggle sits right where this thing was going to zero. So it's also easier to see because of that reason. And the reason this is going, it was going through zero there is, again, this coincidence of matter radiation equality, because the zero here has to do with the scale of matter radiation equality. So, okay, so those are the scales that are there in the linear theory. Any questions about that? No? So now, so now this was just in the linear theory, and so let's ask the question about what happens if you measure this power spectrum, not in linear theory, but let's say you take a simulation and you measure the power spectrum. So, and here I'm just plotting the power spectrum that you measure in the simulation divided by some linear theory power spectrum, which does not have the BAO wiggle. So even on the very large scales, you see the thing is not exactly one, because it's divided not by the linear theory power spectrum, but by some approximation to it, for whatever the reason, doesn't matter. But so here you see, so the red line is this ratio from the simulation, say, and the other lines doesn't matter for this point. But what I want to point out here, so on the very large scales, simulation and linear theory are more or less the same, and eventually they differ quite a bit. And so there is this regime in which everything is very much linear theory, okay, or things are very, corrections to the linear theory are very small. You would need to blow up this to see any difference. There's some sort of transition where you can see difference. This is not one, but okay, it's not very far from one, and eventually it's very different, okay? So this part, you will need to, if you want to do the theory for that, you will need to rely on something that is not some analytical type of calculation. But in this region, perhaps one can do something analytical. And also, one has to remind ourselves that that the goal is to make predictions at the sub-percent level. So when you rely on these numerical simulations, you can get predictions to 10% or something, but it's very difficult to get sub-percent predictions. And in this regime, that's the regime where the information is more qualitative about astrophysics. If you want to do some of these other questions that I talked at the beginning, you will need to get the information over here where you can, the effects, remember, if you remember that you need to do things to a fraction of a percent or 10 to minus 3, it needs to be a regime in which things are easy enough that I'm, you know, some sort of simple deviation from what I had there, and I can try to estimate this either with simulations or with more analytical techniques. But these difficult questions will be answered here. These more qualitative questions, you can answer them anywhere you can. Okay, so this I already said. So that point that I just made was that this difficult question, then one has to be careful to be able to make theoretical predictions that are good enough to be able to extract information about those difficult questions. So the first thing that I want to do in the remaining of the talk now, before I go in the afternoon, is to tell you some things that, so in this respect, it would be very good to have some exact results, things that we know are true for sure, and so, or under simple assumptions that we might want to test, but we know them, that they are exact. It's not something that we computed in a numerical simulation, we don't know how good it is, and in any case, it will never be 10 to minus 3. So what do we have any? So in this development of structure, even though it's a complicated thing, are there any kind of exact results? And yes, there are exact results, and they are basically always for the most part, the exact results follow from the equivalence principle. That's the one thing we have going for us. Some of these exact results are things that we have known for a long time. So, and that we are using, for example, to constrain non-Gaussianity. So one thing is the following. So in the case of large-scale structure, say, for example, in a survey where we are measuring the positions of galaxies, the truth is we have no idea how, I mean, the galaxies, we cannot model the formation of galaxies or their properties and so on. Those, for the purpose of the precision cosmology, galaxies are just some sort of abracadabra thing that is put there, okay? So we need to model this in some way that we can trust, hoping that, but then you can see that if you're going to rely on your detailed measurements on some sort of objects which you have no idea what, I mean, you have some idea, you more or less know the math, blah, blah, but how the details of which, how is it even possible that you can hope to get some answer at the 10 to the minus 3 when the ingredient of the measurement is something that is not trustworthy. But there are certain things we know for sure. For example, if I take some region and I want to ask the question, how many galaxies should have formed, perhaps I don't know the answer, but I know one thing for sure, this cannot depend on the gravitational potential, for example. It can only depend on the second derivatives of the gravitational potential, this how many galaxies form. The number of galaxies that form can be a function of the second derivative of the gravitational potential, never a function of the gravitational potential itself from the equivalence principle. So were we to see something that like that, that is, say, proportional to the gravitational potential, that would mean impossible. Astrophysics could never create such a thing, okay? So astrophysics can never create such a thing, but this can be put into the initial conditions, because what today is we call the gravitational potential, for example, in these models of inflation where there are two fields, the gravitational potential is nothing other than the zeta that I was talking yesterday. It could well be that. During inflation, the second field, the sigma, so there was a second field, say, for example, that converted itself into zeta, which is the gravitational potential. So during the standard evolution of the universe, this gravitational potential cannot affect things. Only its Laplacian or second derivative, the IDJ phi, can affect things. Okay, but during the formation of during inflation, if this gravitational potential was some sigma, this guy is observable at that time. It could create things. It could make things depend on, things could depend on sigma. But, so in other words, things can depend on sigma, which today is the same as the gravitational potential, if that was set up in the beginning, okay? Because in the beginning, sigma was not the gravitational potential. Now, later on, the evolution can only mess up things proportional to the second derivatives of phi, which are the second derivative of sigma. But at the beginning, for example, when you have this multi-field, this sigma can affect things. And in fact, what people have realized is that, for example, if you have a model with this local type non-Gaussianity that we discussed yesterday, in large-scale structure, you see something that looks to you like the number of galaxies, the biasing, the number of galaxies just is proportional to the gravitational potential instead of the Laplacian of the gravitational potential. This is called scale-dependent bias. But that's something that astrophysics can never produce. So even though galaxies are complicated, we don't know how they form. If we see such a thing, we know it's something from the initial conditions. And in fact, the best constraints on FNL local that we have gotten through large-scale structure was by looking at this effect. So it was by looking at something which is naively completely out of control, like the galaxies, but knowing from the equivalence principle that they cannot depend on the gravitational potential, and trying to see if we see such an effect. So, so this just to say that these exact results can be interesting for this purpose. I need to finish, right? At what time? No. At what? When did I start? No. Oh, sorry. No, but I don't want to bother. But yeah, I can go a little longer, but I just got confused with that. Okay, so some of these other exact results that are out there, and these have there's been quite a bit and as I said, there are always some use of the equivalence principle, but. Is this consistency condition. We discussed the consistency condition yesterday in the context of inflation, but there is similar logic and so on can be applied during the late evolution of the universe, and you discover again formulas. So there is some reference, or the authors, I forgot to put the archive number, but you can find formulas that connect, you know, this is an n plus 1 point function of the density with some lower order n point function, and just like this consistency condition, very similar. But these are things that are true. So this is saying that this type of relation apply in the squeeze limit. So if you take some endpoint correlation function in which one of the momenta is going to zero, there is some relation between that and a lower order endpoint function. So the physics is simple enough. It's again the equivalence principle that's behind this. So you're taking some sort of squeeze limit. So you're taking the case one of the momenta or a collection of momenta is going to zero while the other ones are high compared to that. And so this, let's take the case in which one of the momenta is going to zero. So this just means that you're considering the effect of a very long wavelength mode on some shorter things. Okay, so here is the picture of the long wavelength mode. And now I'm measuring something that happened on smaller scales, so some stuff. I mean, the galaxies, whatever. So what is this consistency? These are things that... Notice one thing. These are endpoint functions involving G means galaxies or means whatever. It means something that I'm not in control of. Okay, so this is an exact result even though I'm talking about galaxies. Okay, that's the strange thing about this kind of result. But what is it based on? That if you take the sufficiently squeezed limit, then the lowest... So if you go to the local inertia, so if you make this sufficiently long, you can go to the local inertial frame with respect to that long mode, and you just see how this little region moves there. You're in the local inertial frame, the exact same thing should happen, okay, as if the long wavelength mode was not there. So to prove these kind of things, you make some coordinate transformation, you go to the long local inertial frame, then the physics should be identical. However forms galaxies form, it should be the same whether, I mean, you just went to this falling elevator of the long mode, so you don't see the long mode. And so then this kind of effect only comes from the mapping of the coordinates between the elevator coordinates and the global coordinates. Okay, so in the regime in which this mode gets longer and longer and longer, that is that approximation that... In this region, you don't see that there is the long mode, but you can go to some frame. The effect of the long mode starts with the second derivative of the potential. So anything that looks lower derivatives, you can than the potential, you can get by this kind of procedure. So even if you're talking about galaxies, there's a set of these correlation functions, and I guess. You can use them either to test your understanding of the simulations or to see that, if you think that gravity might be modified and you would not satisfy the equivalence principle, then this kind of you go out there in the data, you try to measure if these kind of things are satisfied, they wouldn't be. Okay, but okay, that's This is maybe okay. So good. So let me skip this. So so just to say that now, it's just I'm giving you some survey of what's going on. But in the last few years, then there was this very large or you know some effort to get some of these exact results for endpoint functions. So the conclusion of all of this is that there are in these squeezed limits when some of the modes are longer than others, there are these universal pieces that unless the equivalence principle is not broken, you can compute. Okay, and in the case of the two-point function, seems simple enough, but there's more complicated. And so that's another place where perhaps that we have theoretical control, both to then test our approximations, test our simulations, or look for a strange at the level required by these very very small effects that we are trying to look for. One connection with of these exact results with something that is observable and we have already seen is what we call the broadening of the BAO peak. So this is already some old thing that people have seen for a long time, which is the following. So I told you that if you take the power spectrum that you have there and you take the Fourier transform, there is this peak in the correlation function. This is this dashed line over here, just that Fourier transform. When you measure this, this is a result from, I think, just simulations, but in the data is the same. So this peak is not as sharp today in our current universe as it is in the linear theory, but it has been broadened by quite a bit. Okay, so you can see this is the data point. So this is a broader peak than it was before. It has been smoothed out. Okay, and at some level, so for the people doing the BAO, this is a nuisance because what they're trying to do is measure very precisely the location of this peak. The sharper the peak, the better it is. Okay, so the fact that the large-scale structure, the evolution of large-scale structure has broadened this peak is a bad thing. So they have ways of doing something. But for the point that I want to make here is the following. So this is a little bit surprising in the following way, in the following sense. If you look, this broadening is pretty substantial. Let me call it order one thing. As you see by eye, very, very big difference between this width over here and this width over there. Okay? Big difference. Now, the BAO peak at 100 megaparsecs, it's way in the linear regime. So if you were to look at the, this is the size of the correlation function on the BAO peak, okay? The correlation function is the value of delta squared, the overdensity squared. But you can see that the BAO peak lies in the super, if you take the square root of this, it tells you the typical value of the overdensity on these scales. Maybe I should have said before, the typical scale that has gone nonlinear, where these nonlinearities are big, is around 10 megaparsecs, few megaparsecs. Like you can see here, okay, from this plot. This one is where the density is roughly one, okay? The BAO is sitting in the place where this thing is 10 to the minus 3, okay? But still, some of this nonlinear dynamics somewhere, somehow, is making an order one effect into this, okay? Do you see what I'm trying to say? So naively, you would say, look, we are trying to do this. I told you there was this nonlinear scale. If you go lower than that, then on larger scales, the effects are very small, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller. 100 megaparsecs is super in the linear regime, okay? So this correlation function is 10 to minus 3, okay? However, if I look in a simulation what happens to this BAO peak, I see that it has changed by order 1, okay? I mean, or in any case, this is not a 10 to minus 3 effect because you see it by eye, okay? So there was something wrong in this counting. I don't have time to go for it, but what's wrong is that there's many, because the universe is not scale invariant, there are all these different scales, not all of these nonlinear effects are created equal, and some of them, in fact, one to do with emotions is bigger, and you have to be careful about it. And it was, but it's the connection with this squeeze limit and these endpoint functions is the following: this nonlinear effect. So what's happening in the what's happening? Imagine this BAO peak is that if you have a galaxy here, there's some excess probability of having a galaxy at some other location, like 100 megaparsec, this blob, this beep, blip, okay? So so you have these two galaxies, there's an excess probability that, but so but galaxies and the nonlinear things are much smaller than this separation. This is 100 megaparsec separation between these two galaxies. The nonlinear stuff of the galaxy formation is few megaparsecs on each of them, okay? So the part that is not under control is the few megaparsec stuff. The 100 is quite under control. So what is producing the smoothing? What is producing the smoothing is modes who have wavelength comparable to this separation that are bringing things, these two galaxies back and forth. So you know, if you're going to change the separation, you need to bring, you move them around, okay? But I told you already that the most of the moving around, the power, that's why I was plotting this. This is the amplitude of the motions of things, as who is contributing to the motions of things. You can see there's a big peak over here. The most of the motions are coming from these scales, okay? So those are the modes that produce most of the motion. They are, and so what's happening is that that these galaxies are being shifted around by the motions produced by those modes, but they are modes that are much larger than the typical size of the formation of galaxies. You can apply this elevator argument, whatever, and use this equivalence principle to realize that, to calculate, or you can see that this smoothing of the BAO peak is produced by modes that individually, when you go to the formation of galaxies, you can remove them by a coordinate transformation. And so you know that this implies that this smoothing of the BAO peak is universal, is the same for every type of galaxy and so on. So these exact results of these techniques can also be used to understand some things that are very clear in the data, like the BAO smoothing. So I guess this is a pictorial representation of this BAO smoothing, just to, so that you... So imagine in the initial conditions, you had a galaxy there, and there was some excess probability of having another galaxy in that ring, 100 megaparsec away. Now you run the simulation. What happens with all the particles that were in this ring? Okay, so in the initial conditions, if you measure the correlation function, there was a big blip, excess probability if you're 100 megaparsecs away from the other one. That's the dark. Now, the evolution of structure just moves things around, and those particles in this ring end up over here in the simulation, say. And so you can see that in some directions, the separation has gotten bigger than the ring, someone up there smaller than the ring. Okay, so then you end up smoothing this excess probability, this blob has been smooth because in some regions it moves in some in the other direction, okay? But these are, so you can see that these motions are produced, but they're pretty coherent about around this circle. So all of this region went in, all of this region went out. So the reason for this is that it's being produced by these large modes that are where the peak of the displacement is. Okay, and so but the galaxies in this case are just little blobs over there. Okay, so the galaxies, if you start putting galaxies into him, is like little blobs. In the places where you see a little concentration, you will have a galaxy. You can see that the scale. So this just to see with your eye, the scale of the formation of these nonlinear things is much smaller than the modes that are producing this motion. So for the purpose of how these guys form, you can go to the, you know, local inertial frame, take, do a coordinate transformation, and forget about these long modes that's doing this motion. And so whether a galaxy of the type A or type B formed here or not is independent of whether there was this mode that was going to move the things in this direction or this other direction. So you can use that to understand the I mean, the dependence on the BAO smoothing. But you can see, so I think this is nice for you to get a pictorial representation of the differences in scale from the formation of object scale, from the scales that is doing most of the motion that you can pick up here by seeing, you know, the coherence of all the things that moved in and move out, okay? So these are, there are very big separations of scales, and we can use those things to our advantage at some of them. Okay, so yeah, let me not go through here. Let me just so some of these endpoint function results then can be applied to the BAO spreading. And let me then, the last thing that I want to tell you is some two other exact and one approximate thing, so that people use. So these are all things that, you know, it's a survey of things that we have, say, in our arsenal in order to be sure that when we do calculations that we are on the right track. So test either also in the data, but at least for the theory people, at least we need to make sure that we understand things. So the other one is in the particular case in which, let's say you have a universe. So this one does not apply to our universe, but another tool that we have is if we you know, do a calculation in, use our techniques in a simpler universe where there are some exact result that we already know, and see if our techniques match that exact result. Okay, so an example of that is here. You have a universe which was always matter dominated, and whose initial conditions were a perfect power law. The power spectrum of initial conditions were just a perfect power law. In a universe, that universe has only one scale that you can make with units of length, which is the wavelength of the modes that have delta equals to one. Okay, that's the only thing with units of, because remember we are doing Newtonian kind of, this is all in Newtonian inside the horizon, so it's Newtonian gravity, so there's no speed of light. Okay, so even though there is a Hubble scale, a Hubble rate, that's a time. Okay, and so there's no speed to make a distance, and if the initial conditions were a power law, the initial conditions do not have a scale either. So there's no scale anywhere. In fact, the only scale you have is where this amplitude of fluctuations at a given time is equal to one. Okay, that's the only thing that there. So that allows you to do the following. That allows you to, if you compute things at a given time, they should be, you should be able to. To rescale coordinates and so on to get the answer of another time. Okay, so there's a scaling symmetry like that, which depends on the because the only scale is defined through the place where the amplitude of fluctuation is equal to one. That depends on the slope of the power spectrum, how it evolves in time, that scale. So you have a family of solutions depending on the slope of the initial conditions, this n, it needs to satisfy some scaling symmetry. So this is quite useful both to test simulations and theory and to guesstimate. So what we typically also do when we do analytical calculations is to approximate the scales that are going nonlinear in our universe. The power spectrum has some certain slope, so we can use this kind of, we can use the results from this kind of scaling to see if we are making sense or to guesstimate the size of various effects. This last thing is not really an exact result, it's just some useful approximation. But it turns out that when you write the equations, for the evolution of, say, you follow some particles, the Newton's law, and so on, you can change course. So this d here is some function of. So you can change the is what we call the growth factor. But for for our purpose, for the purpose of this thing, is just another, is some other time coordinate. So you can use a mother time in such a way, which depends on cosmology. The relation between time and D depends on omega and so on. But for those of you who know, it is just a growth factor. But the equation looks like this, and so, but this when you do this transformation, this quantity over here is very close to one, independent of cosmology. If you just vary, I mean, this is a coincidence as far as I can tell. So this parameter is almost the same for all the cosmologies that we care about, almost the same number, okay? So if that is the case, then if you forget about the fact that when you think about different cosmologies, this might be a little bit different, this equation now has no cosmology in it other than through the scale factor D. So you can get answers for different cosmologies by just knowing, by looking at them at a different time, if you want. You solve everything using this new time, and different cosmologies is the same answer as long as you map the time accordingly. So this is not perfect, but this is not super perfect, but it's good to percent level. So it's for a super good precision, it's not so good, but it's still something that is useful in some intermediate version. So okay, so I told you, you know, just I gave you some survey of exact results that can be used in various ways, and in the afternoon I will tell you more about techniques to solve these equations. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
In the plot of the displacement power spectrum, both the initial positions of these particles that's set by the you're setting the initial positions of the initial conditions.
Yeah. So So that's I guess this. Yeah. So imagine that. So if you write down. So position now Q is the label of the particle in the initial condition. So a particle that started in location Q in the initial condition, at the final condition, well, it started at Q, and then I'm calling this S, the change, how much it moved, the particle Q, how much it moved from the beginning. That's S. And in the beginning, the density is uniform, okay? So the density at the end is given by the determinant of this transformation, or the inverse. So it's 1 over the determinant of dxi dqj. That is because if I do this transformation, I go to if you want a coordinate transformation that takes you from uniform density at the beginning to some final density at the end. And so the density at the end is just given by the density at the beginning times this, and so if you just plug in, it's 1 over the determinant of delta j from here plus dsi dqj, and if you linearize the determinant, this is 1 plus delta, the density. If you linearize this, you get 1 plus the or minus the divergence of S. So. Okay? And so the density is just from this mapping, it starts being the. So the displacement and the density in the linear theory are yeah.
Yeah?
Is there
some hybrid approach between hydrodynamics and Lagrangian dynamics?
So how do people solve? Let's see, where do I have this equation? So, this would be here. So, so for actually for So in hydrodynamics, at each position in space, you have some variables like density, pressure, and so on, and the velocity of the fluid. For the dark matter, that's not a good approximation because you can have multiple streams of dark matter in a given place, and so there's not a unique velocity. So to solve for them, we really, at the end of the day, solve for a bunch of particles always. So we always use for the dark matter something like this. But for the baryons that act more like a fluid, people solve this equation. So in a numerical code simulations, you have a collection of particles that are being followed like that, just using Newton's law and hydrodynamics for the baryons with a pressure term and so on. Now, the problem with then the question is how you solve these hydrodynamical equations. So the one nice thing about following particles is that if you start with some particles and you're forming something, then the particles are going there. So you have more resolution, more in the places where things are forming. While if you solve these equations with just a grid, in fixed grid in space, you form something, then the grid, either you try to adjust the grid, because there's a big dynamical range between how things started and the small things that end at the end. So you either do something like that, or some people also solve the hydrodynamics using particles. It's called the smooth particle hydrodynamics. So they solve equations like this for the hydrodynamics itself. So there are some gas particles which solve some equations like this with an additional force coming from pressure. All of these things introduce numerical artifacts, and the question is which numerical artifact you can live with and stuff like that. Yeah.
So from what you said, it seems like we can use the linear theory till about 100 or 10 megaparsecs, linear perturbation evolution, and after that it becomes nonlinear.
Yes.
So if we get sophisticated with sort of effective field theory or such methods instead of using numerical simulations, what is the smallest scale we can go till with such theories?
Yeah, so I think that's something I will discuss in the afternoon. But so, in megaparsecs. So these theories are not, they are not the figure of merit is not so much, or they not allow you to push too much in scale, but they allow you to have more and more precise measurements. So there will be some. So what happens is the following. So let me just, so there is some scale K star of disaster. So this is some sort of error as a function of K star, some log error, okay? So what typically happens is the following. So by the time you get to here, disaster, okay? Well, this is some log scale, so this would be more or less like a power law. But as you increase, and this is the order one mistake, okay? So as you increase how fancy you're doing this perturbation theory, what you see is that, okay, perhaps you move a little bit this order one in this direction, but also what I think more important that happens is that the slope of this is getting steeper and steeper. So if you put more orders, it goes like this, it goes like that, okay? So because these are higher derivative corrections, so they go with scale steeper. And so if you move away, then you have a much bigger precision. But if you're getting to here, so these are, if you want corrections, k over k star to higher and higher power, so higher derivative things. So they are good if your goal is to move away and then be in more control. If your goal is to, you know, get in this direction, there's no hope. I mean, yes, if you do, as you do better, this k star starts moving. We don't know exactly what this k star is. I mean, this we have to discover, but And it looks like you make some improvements, but the more I think the important thing is this, because the goal is to say measure something 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 here, okay? So So you're really trying to see if you can model everything. The steeper this is, the more you can get to here, and it makes a big difference. At this 10 to the minus 4, it makes a big difference whether you are in this slope and this slope. If you're telling about 1, it makes very little difference. Any other question? Okay.
All right, so let's take a